being king of the realm reduced to a wandering beggar, gnawed from the inside by regret for deeds he did long ago.
"You feel for him, then, Pocket?"
asked Rosemary, the greenish cat-toed witch. "He rescued me from a cruel master and brought me to live in his castle. It's hard to hold hatred with a full stomach and a warm hearth."
"Just so," said Rosemary. "Have some more wine."
She poured some dark liquid into my cup. I sipped it. It tasted stronger, warmer than before.
"We've a gift for you, Pocket."
Rosemary brought out a small leather box from behind her back and opened it. Inside were four tiny stone vials, two red and two black.
"You'll be needing these."
"What are they?" My vision began to blur then. I could hear the witches' voices and drool snoring, but they seemed distant, as if down a tunnel.
"Poison," said the witch.
That was the last I heard from her. The room was gone, and I found myself sitting in a tree near a quiet river and a stone bridge. It was autumn. I could tell as the leaves were turning. Below me, a girl of perhaps 16 was washing clothes in a bucket on the river bank. She was a tiny thing, and I would have thought her a child by her size, but her figure was quite womanly, perfectly proportioned, just a size smaller in scale than most. The girl looked up, as if she heard something. I followed her gaze down the road to a column of soldiers on horseback. Two knights rode at the head of the train, followed by perhaps a dozen others. They rode under my oak tree and paused their horses on the bridge.
"Look at that," said the heavier of the two knights, nodding toward the girl.
I heard his voice, as if it were in my own head.
"Pretty little thing."
"Have her," said the other.
I knew the voice immediately, and with it I saw the face for who it was. Leah. Younger. Stronger. Not nearly so grey. But Leah as sure as I'd ever seen him. The hawk nose, the crystal blue eyes. It was him.
"No," said the younger man. "We need to make York by nightfall. We've no time to find an inn."
"Come here, girl," called Leah.
The girl came up the bank to the road, keeping her eyes to the ground.
"Here!" barked Leah.
The girl hurried across the bridge until she stood only a few feet from him.
"Do you know who I am, girl?"
"A gentleman, sir."
"A gentleman? I am your king, girl. I am Leah."
The girl fell to her knees and stopped breathing.
"This is Canis, Duke of York, Prince of Wales, son of King Bladud, brother to King Leah. And he would have you."
"No, Leah," said the brother. "This is madness."
The girl was trembling now.
"You are brother to the king, and you may have whom you want, when you want," said Leah. He climbed off his horse.
"Stand up, girl."
The girl did, but stiffly, as if she were bracing for a blow. Leah took her chin in his hand and lifted it.
"You are a pretty thing."
"She's a pretty thing, Canis."
"And she is mine. I give her to you."
The king's brother's eyes were wide and there was hunger there, but he said,
"No, we haven't time."
"Now," boomed Leah, "you'll have her now."
With that, Leah grabbed the front of the girl's frock and ripped it, exposing her breasts. When she tried to cover up, he pulled her arms away. Then he held her and barked commands while his brother raped her on the wide stone rail of the bridge. When Canis had finished and fell breathless between her legs, Leah shouldered him aside, then lifted the girl by the waist and threw her over the rail into the river.
"Clean yourself," he shouted.
Then he patted his brother's shoulder.
"There. She'll not haunt your dreams tonight."
"All subjects are property of the king and mine to give, Canis. You may have any woman you want, except one."
They mounted their horses and rode away. Leah hadn't even looked to see if she could swim. I couldn't move. I couldn't cry out. All during the attack on the girl, I felt as if I'd been lashed to the tree. Now I watched her crawl naked from the river, her clothes in tatters behind her, and she curled into a ball on the riverbank and sobbed. Suddenly I was whisked out of the tree like a feather on an errant wind, and I settled on the roof of a two-story house in a village. It was market day, and everyone was out, going from cart to cart, table to table, bargaining for meat and vegetables, pottery and tools. A girl stumbled down the street, a pretty little thing, perhaps 16 or 17, with a tiny babe in arms. She stopped at every booth and showed them the babe. Then the villagers would reward her with rude laughter and send her to the next booth. "He's a prince," she said. "His father was a prince."
"Go away, girl. You're mad. No wonder no one will have you, tart."
"But he's a prince."
"He looks to be a drowned puppy, lass. You'll be lucky if he lives the week out."
From one end of the village to the other, she was laughed at and scorned. One woman, who must have been the girl's mother, simply turned away and hid her face in shame. I floated overhead as the girl ran to the edge of town, across the bridge where she'd been raped, and up to a compound of stone buildings, one with a great soaring steeple. A church. She made her way to the wide double door, and there she lay her baby on the steps. I recognized those doors. I'd seen them 1,000 times. This was the entrance to the abbey at Dog Snogging. The girl ran away, and I watched as a few minutes later the doors opened and a broad-shouldered nun bent and picked up the tiny squalling baby. Mother Basil had found him. Suddenly I was at the river again, and the girl, that pretty little thing, stood on the wide stone rail of the bridge, crossed herself, and leapt in. She did not swim. The green water settled over her. My mother. When I woke, the witches were gathered around me like I was a sumptuous pie just out of the oven, and they were ravenous pie whores.
"So, you're a bastard, then," said Parsley. "And an orphan," said Sage. "Both at once," said Rosemary. "Surprised, then?" said Parsley. "Lear not quite the kind old codger you thought him, eh? A royal bastard you are."
I gagged a bit in response to the crone's collective breath and sat up.
"Would you back off, you disgusting old cadavers?"
"Well, strictly speaking, only Rosemary's a cadaver," said the tall witch, Parsley.
"You drugged me. Put that nightmare vision in my head."
"Aye, we did drug you, but you was just looking through a window to the past. There was no vision except what happened." "Got to see your dear mum, didn't you?" said Rosemary. "How lovely for you."
"I had to watch her raped and driven to suicide, you mad hag."
"You needed to know, Little Pocket, before you went on to Dover."
"Dover? I'm not going to Dover. I have no desire to see Lear." Even as I said it, I felt fear run down my spine like the tip of a spike. Without Lear, I was no longer a fool. I had no purpose. I had no home. Still, after what he had done, I would have to find some other means to make my way. I can rent out Drool for ploughing fields and hoisting bales of wool and such. We'll make our way.
Maybe he wants to go on to Dover.
I looked over to Drool, who I thought to be still asleep by the fire, but he was sitting there, staring at me wide-eyed, as if someone had frightened him and he'd forgotten how to talk.
"You didn't give him the same potion you gave me, did you?"
"It was in the wine," said Sage.
I went to the natural and put my arm around his shoulder, or as far around as I could reach anyway.
"Drool, lad. You're fine, lad."
I knew how horrified I had been, with my superior mind and understanding of the world. Poor Drool must have been terrified.
"What did you wicked hag show him?"
"He had a window in the past, just like you."
The great oaf looked up at me then.
"I was raised by wolves," said he.
Nothing can be done now, lad. Don't be sad. With all things in our past we're better not remembering. I glared at the witches.
I ain't sad, Drool said, standing up.
He had to stoop to avoid hitting his head on the roof beams.
My brother nipped at me 'cause I don't have no fur. But he don't have no hands, so I throwed him against a tree and he didn't get up.
You're but a pathetic dimwit, said I. You can't be blamed.
My mum only had 8 teats, but after that there was only 7 of us, so I got 2. It were lovely.
He didn't really seem that bothered by the whole experience. Tell me, Drool, have you always known you were raised by wolves?
Aye. I want to go outside and have a wee on a tree now, Pocket. You want to come?
No. You go, love. I'm going to stay here and shout at the old ladies. Once the natural was gone, I turned on them again. I'm finished doing your bidding. Whatever politics you want to engineer, I'll have no more part of it. The crones laughed at me in chorus, then coughed until finally Rosemary, the greenish witch, calmed her breath with a sip of wine.
No, lad, nothing so sordid as politics. We're about vengeance, pure and simple. We don't give a weasel's twat about politics and succession.
But you're evil incarnate and in triplicate, aren't you? Said I, respectfully. One must give due.
Aye, evil is our trade, but not so deep a darkness as politics. Better business to dash a suckling babe's brains upon the bricks than to boil in that tawdry cauldron. Aye, said Sage. Breakfast, anyone?
She was stirring something in the cauldron. I assumed it was the leftover hallucination wine from the night before. Well, revenge, then. I've no taste left for it.
Not even for revenge on the bastard Edmund?
Edmund? What a storm of suffering that blackguard had loosed upon the world. But still, if I never had to see him again, couldn't I forget about his damage? Edmund will find his just reward, said I, not believing it for a second.
And Lear?
I was angry with the old man. But what revenge would I have on him now? He had lost all. And I had always known him to be cruel, but so long as his cruelty didn't extend to me, I was blind to it. No, not even Lear.
Fine, then. Where will you go?
Asked Sage. She pulled a ladle of steaming liquid from the pot and blew on it. I'll take the natural into Wales. We can call it castles until someone takes us in.
Then you'll miss the Queen of France at Dover.
Cordelia? I thought bloody fucking froggy King Jeff was at Dover. Cordelia is with him? The hags cackled.
Oh, no. King Jeff is in Burgundy. Queen Cordelia commands the French forces at Dover.
Oh, bugger, said I.
You'll want to take them poisons we fixed for you,
said Rosemary.
Keep them on you at all times, and need for them will present itself.
XXI. At the White Cliffs. Years ago.
Pocket, said Cordelia. Have you ever heard of this warrior queen named Boudica?
Cordelia was about 15 at the time, and she had sent for me because she wished to discuss politics. She lay on her bed with a large leather volume open before her.
No, lamb. Who was she queen of?
Why, of the pagan Britons. Of us.
Lear had recently shifted back to the pagan beliefs, thus opening a whole new world of learning for Cordelia.
Ah, that explains it. Educated in a nunnery, love. I have a very shallow knowledge of pagan ways. Although I have to say, their festivals are smashing. Rampant drunken shagging while wearing flower wreaths seems far superior to midnight mass and self-flagellation, but then I'm a fool.
Well, it says here that she kicked 9 colours of shit out of the Roman legions when they invaded.
Really?
That's what it says. 9 colours of shit.
I'm paraphrasing. Why do you think we've no warrior queens any more?
Well, Lamb, war requires swift and resolute action.
And you're saying that a woman can't move with swift resolve?
I'm saying no such thing. She may move with swiftness and resolve, but only after choosing the correct outfit and shoes, and therein lies the undoing of any potential warrior queen, I suspect.
Oh, bollocks!
I'll wager your Boudicca lived before they invented clothing. Easy days, then, for a warrior queen. Just hitch up your tits and start taking heads, it was. Now, well, I dare say erosion would take down a country before most women could pick out their invading kit.
Most women? But not me?
Of course not you, Lamb. Them. I meant only weak-willed tarts like your sisters.
Pocket, I think I shall be a warrior queen.
Of what? The Royal Petting Zoo at Boffinshire?
You'll see, Pocket. The whole of the sky will darken with the smoke from my army's fires. The ground will tremble under their horses' hooves, and kings will kneel outside their city walls, crowns in hand, begging to surrender rather than feel the wrath of Queen Cordelia fall upon their people. But I shall be merciful.
Goes without saying, doesn't it?
And you, fool, will no longer be able to behave like the right shit that you are.
Fear and trembling, love. That's all you'll get from me. Fear and bloody trembling.
As long as we understand each other.
So, it sounds as if you're thinking of conquering more than just the petting zoo.
Europe,
said the princess, as if stating the unadorned truth.
Europe, said I.
To start,
said Cordelia. Well, then you'd better get moving, hadn't you?
Yes, I suppose,
said Cordelia, with a great silly grin.
Dear Pocket, would you help me pick an outfit?
She's already taken Normandy, Brittany, and the Aquitaine, said Edgar. And Belgium soils itself at the mention of her name.
Cordelia can be a bundle of rumpus when she sets her mind to something, said I. I smiled at the thought of her barking orders to the troops, all fury and fire from her lips, but those crystal blue eyes hinting laughter at every turn.
I missed her.
Oh, I did betray her love and flay her sweet heart with stubborn pride, said Leah, looking madder and weaker than when I'd seen him last.
Where is Kent? I asked Edgar, ignoring the old king. Drool and I had found them above a cliff at Dover. They all sat with their backs to a great chalk boulder. Gloucester, Edgar, and Leah. Gloucester snored softly, his head on Edgar's shoulder. We could see smoke from the French camp not 2 miles away in the distance. He's gone to Cordelia to ask her to accept her father into her camp.
Why didn't you go yourself? I asked Leah. I am afraid, said the old man.
He hid his head under his arm, like a bird trying to escape the daylight beneath its wing.
It was wrong.
I wanted him strong, I wanted him stubborn, I wanted him full of arrogance and cruelty. I wanted to see those parts of him I knew were thriving when he'd thrown my mother on the stones so many years ago. I wanted to scream at him, humiliate him, hurt him in 11 places, and watch him crawl in his own shit, dragging his bloody pride and guts behind him in the dirt. There was no revenge to be satisfied on this trembling shell of Leah. I wanted no part of it. I'm going to go nap behind those rocks, said I. Drool, keep watch. Wake me when Kent returns.
Aye, Pocket.
The natural went to the far side of Edgar's boulder, sat and stared out over the sea. If we were attacked by a ship, he'd be Johnny on the spot. I lay down and slept perhaps an hour before they were shouting behind me, and I looked over my boulders to see Edgar holding his father's head, steadying him as the old man stood on a rock, perhaps a foot above the ground.
Are we at the edge?
Aye. There are fishermen on the beach below that look like mice. Dogs look like ants.
What do the horses look like?
Asked Gloucester. There aren't any horses. Just fishermen and dogs. Don't you hear the sea crashing below?
Yes. Yes, I do. Farewell, Edgar, my son. I am sorry. Gods, do your will.
With that, the old man leaped off the rock, expecting to plummet hundreds of feet to his death, I reckon, so he was somewhat surprised when he met the ground in an instant.
"Oh, my lord! Oh, my lord!" said Edgar, trying to use a different voice and failing completely. "Sir, you have duly fallen from the cliffs above."
"I have," said Gloucester.
"Aye, sir, can you not see?"
"Well, no, you git. My eyes are bandaged and bloody. Can you not see?"
"Sorry. What I saw was you fall from a great height and land as softly as if you were a feather floating down."
"I am dead, then," said Gloucester.
He sank to his knees and seemed to lose his breath.
"I am dead, yet I still suffer. My grief is manifest. My eyes ache, even though they are not there."
"That's because he's fucking with you," said I.
"What?"
said Gloucester.
"Shh," said Edgar.
"'Tis a mad beggar. Pay him no heed, good sir."
"Fine, you're dead. Enjoy," said I. I lay back on the ground, out of the wind, and pulled my coxcomb over my eyes.
"Come, come sit with me," said Lear.
I sat up and watched Lear lead the blind man to his nest beneath the great boulders.
"Let the cruelties of the world slide off our bent backs, friend."
Lear put his arm around Gloucester and held him while he spoke to the sky.
"My king," said Gloucester, "I am safe in your mercy, my king."
"Aye, king, but I have no soldiers, no lands. No subject quakes before me, no servants wait, and even your bastard son hath treated you better than my own daughters."
"Oh, for fuck's sake," said I.
But I could see that the old blind man was smiling, and for all his suffering, he found comfort in his friend the king, no doubt having been blinded to his scoundrel nature long before Cornwall and Regan took his eyes, blinded by loyalty, blinded by title, blinded by shoddy patriotism and false righteousness. He loved his mad murdering king. I lay back down to listen.
"Let me kiss your hand," said Gloucester.
"Let me wipe it first," said Lear. "It smells of mortality."
"I smell nothing, and see nothing evermore. I am not worthy."
"Art thou mad? See with your ears, Gloucester. Have you never seen a farmer's dog bark at a beggar, and thus chase him off? Is that dog the voice of authority? Is he better than the many for denying the man's hunger? Is a sheriff righteous who whips the whore when it is for his own lust he punishes her? See, Gloucester, see who is worthy. Now we are stripped of finery, see? Small vices show through tattered clothes when all is hidden beneath fur and fine robes. Plate sin with gold, and the strong lance of justice breaks on decoration. Blessed are you that you cannot see, for you cannot see me for what I am. Wretched."
"No," said Edgar, "your impertinence comes from madness. Do not weep, good king."
"Do not weep. We weep when we first smell the air. When we are born, we cry that we come to this great stage of fools.
No, all shall be well again, and—" And there was a thump, followed by another, and a yowl.
"Die, thou blind mole," came a familiar voice.
I sat up in time to see Oswald standing over Gloucester, a bloodied stone in one hand, his sword driven down through the old earl's chest.
"You'll not poison my lady's cause further."
He twisted the blade, and blood bubbled up out of the old man. But no sound did he make. He was quite dead. Oswald yanked his blade free and kicked Gloucester's body across Lear's lap as the king cowered against the boulder. Edgar lay unconscious at Oswald's feet. The vermin drew back as if to drive his sword into Edgar's spine.
"Oswald!" I shouted.
I stood behind my boulders as I drew a throwing knife from the sheath at my back. The worm turned to me and pulled his blade up. He dropped the bloody stone he'd used to brain Edgar. "We have an arrangement," said I, "and further slaughter of my cohorts will cause me to doubt your sincerity."
"Sod off, fool. We've no arrangement. You're a lying cur."
"Moi?" said I in perfect fucking French. "I can give you your lady's heart, and not in the unpleasant, eviscerated, no shagging except the corpse way."
"You have no such power. You've not bewitched Regan's heart, neither. 'Tis she who sent me here to kill this blind traitor who turns minds against our forces, and to deliver this."
He pulled a sealed letter from his jerkin.
"A letter of marque, giving you permission in the name of the Duchess of Cornwall to be a total twat goblin."
"Your wit is dull, fool.
It is a love letter to Edmund of Gloucester. He's set out for here with a scouting party to assess the French forces."
"My wit is dull? My wit is dull?"
"Yes, dull," said Oswald. "Now, en garde," said he, in barely passable fucking French. "Yes," said I, with an exaggerated nod, "yes." And with that, Oswald found himself seized by the throat and dashed several times against the boulders, which relieved him of his sword, his dagger, the love letter, and his coin purse. Drool then held the steward up and squeezed his throat, slowly but sternly, causing wet gurgling noises to bubble from his foul gullet. I said, "While unscathed by my rapier wit, you're choked to death by a giant git. By this gentle jester is argument won. I'll leave you two to have your fun." Oswald seemed somewhat surprised by the turn of events, so much so that both his eyes and tongue protruded from his face in a wholly unhealthy way. He then began to surrender his various fluids, and Drool had to hold him away to keep from being fouled by them.
"Drop him," said Leah, who still cowered by the boulders.
Drool looked to me, and I shook my head ever so slightly.
"Die, thou badger-shagging spunk monkey," said I.
When Oswald stopped kicking and simply hung limp and dripping, I nodded to my apprentice, who tossed the steward's body over the cliff as easily as if it were an apple core. Drool went down on one knee over Gloucester's body.
"I were going to teach him to be a fool."
"Aye, lad, I know you were." I stood by my boulders, resisting the urge to comfort the great murderous git with a pat on the shoulder. There was a rustling from over the top of the hill, and I thought I heard the sound of metal on metal through the wind.
"Now he's blind
and dead," said the natural.
"Bugger," said I, under my breath, then to Drool, "hide, and don't fight, and don't call for me." I fell flat to the ground as the first soldier topped the hill.
"Bugger! Bugger! Bugger! Bloody bollocks in buggering bugger!" I reflected serenely.
Then I heard the voice of the bastard Edmund.
"Look, my fool. And what's this? The king? What good fortune! You'll make a fine hostage to stay the hand of the Queen of France and her forces."
"Have you no heart?" said Leah,
petting the head of his dead friend Gloucester. I peeked out between my rocks. Edmund was looking at his dead father with the expression of someone who has just encountered rat scat in his toast for tea.
"Yes. Well, tragic, I suppose, but with succession of his title determined and his sight gone, a timely exit was only polite. Who's this other deader?"
Edmund kicked his unconscious half-brother in the shoulder.
"A beggar,"
said Drool.
"He were trying to protect the old man."
"This is not the sword of a beggar. Neither is this purse."
Edmund picked up Oswald's purse. "These belong to Goneril's man, Oswald."
"Aye, my lord,"
said Drool.
"Well, where is he?"
"On the beach."
"On the beach? He climbed down and left his purse and sword here."
"He was a tosser," said Drool, "so I tossed him over. He killed your old dar."
"Oh, Quite right. Well done, then. Edmund threw the purse to Drool. Use it to bribe your jailer for a bread crust. Take them. The bastard motioned for his men to seize Drool and Leah. When the old man had trouble standing, Drool lifted him to his feet and steadied him. What about the bodies? Asked Edmund's captain. Let the French bury them. Quickly, to the White Tower. I've seen enough. Leah coughed then, a dry, feeble cough like the creaking of death's door hinges, until I thought he might collapse into a pile of blue. One of Edmund's men gave the old man a sip of water, which seemed to quell the coughing, but he couldn't stand or support his weight. Drool hoisted him up on one shoulder and carried him up the hill. The old man's bony bottom bouncing on the great git's shoulder as if it was the cushion of a sedan chair. When they were gone, I scrambled out of my hiding place and over to Edgar's prostrate body. The wound on his scalp wasn't deep, but it had bled copiously, as scalp wounds are wont to do. The resulting puddle of gore had probably saved Edgar's life. I got him propped against the boulder and brought him around with some gentle smacking and a stout splashing from his water skin.
What?
Edgar looked around and shook his head to clear his vision, a motion he clearly regretted immediately. Then he spotted his father's corpse and wailed. I'm sorry, Edgar, said I. 'Twas Goneril's steward Oswald knocked you out and killed him. Drool strangled the scurvy dog and tossed him over the cliff. Where is Drool? And the king? Taken by your bastard brother's men. Listen, Edgar, I need to follow them. You go to the French camp, take them a message. Edgar's eyes rolled, and I thought he might pass out again, so I threw some more water in his face. Look at me, Edgar. You must go to the French camp. Tell Cordelia that she should attack the White Tower directly. Tell her to send ships up the Thames and bring a force through London overland as well. Kent will know the plan. Have her sound the trumpet 3 times before they attack the keep. Do you understand?
3 times.
The White Tower. I tore the back off the dead Earl's shirt, wadded it up, and gave it to Edgar. Here, hold this on your noggin to staunch the blood. And tell Cordelia not to hold for fear for her father's life. I'll see to it that it's not an issue.
Aye, said Edgar.
She'll not save the king by holding the attack.
At the White Tower.
Tosser! Cried the raven.
No help was he in my stealthy entry to the White Tower. I'd packed my bells with clay and darkened my face with the same, but no amount of camouflage would help if the raven raised an alarm. I should have had a guard bring him down with a crossbow bolt long before I left the tower. I lay in a shallow, flat-bottomed skiff I'd borrowed from a ferryman, covered with rags and branches so I might appear just another mass of jetsam floating in the Thames. I paddled with my right hand, and the cold water felt like needles until my arm went numb. Sheets of ice drifted in the water around me. Another good cold night, and I might have walked into the Traitor's Gate rather than paddled. The river fed the moat, and the moat led under a low arch and through the gate where English nobility had been bringing their family members for hundreds of years on the way to the chopping block. 2 ironclad gates fit together at the centre of the arch, chained in the middle below the waterline, and they moved ever so slightly in the current. There was a gap there, at the top, where the gates met. Not so wide that a soldier with weapons could fit through, but a cat, a rat, or a spry and nimble fool on the slim side might easily pass over. And so I did. There were no guards at the stone steps inside, but 12 feet of water separated me from them, and my skiff would not fit through the gap at the top of the gate where I was perched. A fool was getting wet. There was no way around it. But it seemed to me that the water was shallow, only a foot or two deep. Perhaps I could keep my shoes dry. I took them off and tucked them into my jerkin, then slid down the gate into the cold water. Great dog-buggering bollocks, it was cold. Only to my knees, but cold. And I would have made it undiscovered, methinks, if I hadn't let slip a rather emphatic whisper of,
Great dog-buggering bollocks, that's cold.
I was met at the top of the stairs by the pointy part of a halberd, levelled malevolently at my chest.
"For fuck's sake," said I, "do your worst, but get it done and drag my body inside where it's warm."
"Pocket?" said the yeoman at the other end of the spear.
"Sir?"
"Aye," said I.
"I haven't seen you for months. What's that all over your face?"
"It's clay. I'm in disguise."
"Oh, right.
Why don't you come in and warm up? Must be dreadful cold in your wet stocking feet there."
"Good thought, lad," said I. It was the young spot-faced yeoman whom I'd chastised on the wall when Regan and Goneril were first arriving to gain their inheritance. "Shouldn't you stay at your post, though? Duty and all that?" He led me across the cobbled courtyard, into a servant's entrance to the main castle, and down the stairs into the kitchen.
"Nah, it's the traitor's gate, innit? Lock on it as big as your head. Ain't no one coming through there. Not all bad. It's out of the wind. Not like up on the wall. You know the Duchess Regan is living here at the tower now. I took your advice about not talking about her boffnacity. Even with the Duke dead and all, can't be too careful. Although, I caught sight of her in a dressing gown one day as she was up on the parapet outside of Sola. Fine flanks on that princess, despite the danger of death and all for saying so, sir."
"Aye, the lady is fair, and her gadonk as fine as frog fur, lad, but even your steadfast silence will get you hung if you don't cease with the thinking aloud."
"Pocket, you scroungy flea-bitten plague rat!"
"Bubble, love," said I, "thou dragon-breathed wart-farm, how art thou?"
The ox-bottomed cook tried to hide her joy by casting an onion at me, but there was a grin there.
"You've not eaten one full plate since you were last in my kitchen, have you?"
"We heard you was dead,"
said Squeak, a crescent of a smile for me beneath her freckles.
"Feed the pest," said Bubble,
"and clean that mess off his face. Rutting with the pigs again, were you, Pocket?"
"Jealous?"
"Not bloody likely," said Bubble.
Squeak sat me down on a stool by the fire, and while I warmed my feet, she scrubbed the clay from my face and out of my hair, mercilessly battering me with her bosoms as she worked.
"Ah, home sweet home."
"So, has anyone seen Drool?"
"In the dungeon with the king," said Squeak, "although the guard ain't supposed to know it."
She eyed the young yeoman who stood by.
"I knew that," he said.
"What of the king's men, his knights and guards, in the barracks?"
"Nah," said the yeoman.
"Castle guard was a dog's breakfast until Captain Curran came down from Gloucester. He's got a noble-born knight as captain of every watch, and the old guard man for man with any new ones. Crashing huge camps of soldiers outside the walls, forces of Cornwall to the west and Albany on the north. They say the Duke of Albany is staying with his men at camp, won't come to the tower."
"Wise choice, with so many vipers about the castle."
"What of the princesses?" I asked Bubble. Although she never seemed to leave her kitchen, she knew what was going on in every corner of the fortress.
"They ain't talking," said Bubble. "Taking meals in their old quarters they had when they was girls. Goneril in the east tower of the main keep, Regan in her solar on the outer wall on the south. They'll come together for the midday meal, but only if that bastard Gloucester is there."
"Can you get me to them, Bubble,
unseen?"
"I could sew you up in a suckling pig and send it over."
"Yes, lovely, but I did hope to return undiscovered, and trailing gravy might draw the attention of the castle's cats and dogs. Regrettably, I've had experience with such things."
"We can dress you as one of the serving lads, then," said Squeak. "Regan had us bring in boys instead of our usual maids. She likes to taunt and threaten them until they cry."
I regarded Bubble with steely recrimination. "Why didn't you suggest that?"
"I wanted to see you sewed up in a suckling pig, you oily rascal."
Bubble has struggled with a deep affection for me for years.
"Very well, then," said I. "A serving boy it is."
"You know, Pocket,"
said Cordelia, aged 16,
"Goneril and Regan say that my mother was a sorceress."
"Yes, I'd heard that, love."
If that's so, then I'm proud of it. It means she didn't need some mangy man for her power. She had her own.
Banished, then, wasn't she?
Well, yes. That or drowned, no one will really say. Father forbids me to ask about it. But my point is that a woman should come to her power on her own. Did you know that the wizard Merlin gave up his powers to Vivian in exchange for her favours, and she became a great sorceress and queen, and put Merlin to sleep in a cave for 100 years for his trouble?
Men are like that, lamb. You give them your favours, and next thing you know, they're snoring away like a bear in a cave. Way of the world, it is.
You didn't do that when my sisters gave you their favours.
They did no such thing.
They did, too. Many times. Everyone in the castle knows it.
Vicious rumours.
Fine, then. When you have enjoyed the favours of women, who shall remain nameless, did you fall asleep afterwards?
Well, no. But neither did I give up my magical powers or my kingdom.
But you would have, wouldn't you?
Say, enough talk of sorcerers and such. What say we go down to the chapel and convert back to Christianity? Drool drank all the communion wine and ate all the leftover host when the bishop was ousted, so I'll wager he's blessed enough to bring us into the fold without clergy. Burped the body of Christ for a week, he did.
You're trying to change the subject.
Curses! Discovered! Exclaimed the puppet Jones. That'll teach you, you sooty-souled snake. Have him whipped, princess.
Cordelia laughed, liberated Jones from my grasp, and clouted me on the chest with him. Even when she was grown, she bore a weakness for puppety conspiracy and Punch and Judy justice.
Now, fool, speak truth, if the truth in you hasn't died starving from your neglect. Would you give up your powers and your kingdom for a lady's favour?
That would depend on the lady, wouldn't it?
Say me, for example.
Vous? Said I, my eyebrows raised in the manner of the perfectly fucking French.
Oui,
said she, in the language of love.
Not a chance, said I. I'd be snoring before you had time to declare me your personal deity,
which you would, of course.
It's a burden I bear. Deep sleep of the innocent I'd have. Or, you know, the deep sleep of the deeply shagged innocent.
I suspect, come morning, you'd have to remind me of your name.
You didn't sleep after my sisters, had you? I know it.
Well, threat of violent post-coital death will keep you on the alert, won't it? She crawled across the rug until she was close then.
You are a dreadful liar.
What was your name?
She clouted me on the head with Jones and kissed me, quickly but with feeling. That was the only time.
I'd have your power and your kingdom, fool.
Give me back my puppet, thou nameless tart.
Regan's solar was bigger than I remembered it. A fairly grand round room with a fireplace and a dining table. 6 of us brought in her supper and set it out on the table. She was all in red, as usual, snowy shoulders and raven hair warmed to the eye by orange firelight.
Wouldn't you rather lurk behind the tapestry pocket?
She waved the others out of the room and closed the door. I kept my head down.
How did you know it was me?
You didn't cry when I shouted at you.
Blast! I should have known.
And you were the only serving boy wearing a codpiece.
Can't hide one's light under a bushel, can one? She was infuriating. Did nothing surprise her? She spoke as if I'd been sent for and she'd been expecting me at any moment. Rather took the joy out of all the stealth and disguise. I was tempted to tell her she'd been duped and drool shagged just to see her reaction. But alas, there were still guards who were loyal to her, and I wasn't sure she wouldn't have me killed as it was. I'd left my knives with Bubble in the kitchen, not that they'd help against a platoon of yeomen.
So, lady, how goes the morning?
Surprisingly well. Grief suits me, I think. Grief or war, I'm not sure which. But I've had good appetite and my complexion's been rosy.
She picked up a hand mirror and regarded herself, then caught my reflection and turned.
But, Pocket, what are you doing here?
Oh, loyalty to the cause and all. With the French at our bloody doors, thought I'd come back to help defend home and hearth. It was probably best we not pursue the reasons why I was there, so I pressed on.
How goes the war, then?
Complicated. Affairs of state are complicated, Pocket. I wouldn't expect a fool to understand.
But I'm a royal now, kitten. Didn't you know?
She put down her mirror and looked as if she might burst out laughing.
Silly fool! If you could catch nobility by touch, you'd have been a knight years ago, wouldn't you? But alas, you're still common as cat shit.
Ha! Yes, once. But now, cousin, blue blood runs in my veins. In fact, I've a mind to start a war and shag some relatives, which I believe are the prime pastimes of royalty.
Nonsense, and don't call me cousin.
Shag the country and kill some relatives, then? I've been noble less than a week. I don't have all the protocol memorized yet.
Oh, and we are cousins, kitten.
Our fathers were brothers.
Impossible.
Regan nibbled at some dried fruit Bubble had laid out on the tray.
Lear's brother, Canis, raped my mother on a bridge in Yorkshire while Lear held her down. I am the issue of that unpleasant union, your cousin. I bowed, at your bloody service.
A bastard! I might have known!
Oh, but bastards are vessels of promise, are they not? Or didn't I watch you slay your lord, the Duke, to run to the arms of a bastard, who is, I believe, now the Earl of Gloucester?
By the way, how goes the romance? Torrid and unsavoury, I trust? She sat down then, and ran her fingernails through her jet hair as if raking thoughts out of a scalp.
Oh, I fancy him fine, although he's been a bit disappointing since that first time. But the intrigue is bloody exhausting. What with Goneril trying to bed Edmund, and he not being able to show me deference for fear of losing Albany's support, and bloody France invading in the midst of it all. If I'd known all that my husband had to tend to, I'd have waited a while before killing him.
There, there, kitten.
I moved around behind her and rubbed her shoulders.
Your complexion is rosy, and your appetite good, and you are, as always, a veritable feast of shagability. Once you're queen, you can have everyone beheaded and take a long nap.
That's just it. It's not like I can just put on the crown and go sovereigning merrily along God, St. George, and the whole rotting mess into history. I have to defeat the fucking French. Then I've got to kill Albany, Goneril, and I suppose I'll have to find Father and have something heavy fall on him, or the people will never accept me.
Good news on that, love. Lear's in the dungeon, mad as a hatter, but alive.
He is?
Aye. Edmund just returned from Dover with him.
You didn't know?
Edmund is back?
Not 3 hours ago. I followed him back.
Bastard! He hasn't even sent word that he's returned. I sent a letter to him in Dover.
This letter?
I took the letter that Oswald had dropped. I'd broken the seal, of course, but she recognized it and snatched it out of my hand.
How did you get that? I sent that with Goneril's man, Oswald, to give to Edmund personally.
Yes. Well, I sent Oswald to Vermin Valhalla before delivery was secured.
You killed him?
I told you, kitten. I am nobility now. A murderous little cunt like the rest of you. Just as well, too. That letter's a flitty bit of butterfly toss, isn't it? Don't you have any advisers to help you with that sort of thing? A chancellor or a chamberlain? A bloody bishop or someone?
I've no one. Everyone is at the castle in Cornwall.
Oh, love, let your cousin Pocket help.
Would you?
Of course. First, let's see to sister. I took 2 of the vials from the purse at my belt. This red one is deadly poison, but the blue one is only like a poison, giving the same signs as if one is dead, but they will but sleep 1 day for each drop they drink.
You could put 2 drops of this in your sister's wine, say, when you're ready to attack the French, and for 2 days she would sleep the sleep of the dead while you and Edmund did your will, and without losing the support of Albany in the war.
And the poison?
Well, kitten, the poison may not be needed. You could defeat France, take Edmund for your own, and come to an agreement with your sister in Albany.
I have an agreement with them now. The kingdom is divided as father decreed.
I'm only saying that you may fight the French, have Edmund, and not have to slay your sister.
And what if we don't defeat France?
Well, then, you have the poison, don't you?
Well, that's bollocks counselling, said Regan.
Wait, cousin, I haven't told you the part where you make me Duke of Buckingham yet. I'd like that dodgy old palace, Hyde Park. St. James's Park and a monkey.
You're daft,
named Jeff.
Get out!
I palmed the love letter from the table as I exited. Quickly through the corridors, across the courtyard, and back to the kitchen where I traded my codpiece for a pair of waiter's breeches. It was one thing to leave Jones in my coxcomb with the ferryman, another to secret my blades away with Bubble, but giving up my codpiece was like losing my spirit. I was nearly undone by its enormity, said I to Squeak, to whom I handed the portable den of my manly iniquity.
Aye, a family of squirrels could nest in the extra space,
Squeak observed, dropping a handful of the walnut she'd been shelling into the empty prick pouch.
Wonder you didn't rattle like a dried gourd when you walked, said Bubble.
Fine. Cast aspersions on my manhood if you will, but I'll not protect you when the French arrive. They're unnaturally fond of public snogging, and they smell of snails and cheese. I will laugh, ha, as you both are mercilessly cheese-snogged by froggy marauders.
Don't really sound that bad to me, said Squeak.
Pocket, you'd better be off, lad, said Bubble. Goneril's supper is going up now.
Adieu, said I, a preview of the Frenchy future of my former friends and soon-to-be frog-snogged traitorous tarts.
Adieu.
I bowed.
I feigned fainting with a great wrist-to-brow flourish, and I left.
I admit it. One does like to lubricate his recurrent entrances and exits with a bit of melodrama. Performance is all to the fool.
Goneril's quarters were less spacious than Regan's, but luxurious, and there was a fire going. I hadn't set foot here since she'd left the castle to marry Albany, but upon returning I found I was simultaneously aroused and filled with dread, memories simmering under the lid of consciousness, I suppose. She wore cobalt, with gold trim, daringly cut. She must have known Edmund was back.
Pumpkin!
Pocket!
What are you doing here? She waved the other servers and a young lady who had been braiding her hair out of the room.
And why are you dressed in that absurd outfit?
I know, said I, poncy breeches. Without my codpiece I feel defenceless.
I think they make you look taller,
she said. A dilemma. Taller in breeches or stunningly virile in a cod. Both illusions, each with its advantage.
Which do you think makes a better impression on the fairer sex, love? Tall or hung?
Isn't your apprentice both?
But he's...
Oh.
Yes.
She bit into a winter plum.
I see, said I.
So, what is it with Edmund? Or the black kit?
What it was she was bewitched, was what it was.
Edmund?
She sighed.
I don't think Edmund loves me.
And I sat down, with all of Goneril's luncheon repast set before me, and considered cooling my forehead in the tureen of broth. Love? Sodding, bloody, tossing, bloody, sodding, bloody love? Irrelevant, superfluous, bloody, ruddy, rotten, sodding love? What ho? Wherefore? What the fuck? Love?
Love? Said I.
No one has ever loved me, said Goneril.
What about your mother?
Surely your mother.
I don't remember her. Leah had her executed when we were little. I didn't know. It was not to be spoken of.
Jesus, then? Comfort in Christ?
What comfort? I'm a duchess pocket, a princess, perhaps a queen. You can't rule in Christ. Are you daft? You have to ask Christ to leave the room. Your very first war or execution, and you're right fucked for forgiveness, aren't you? There's Jesus' disapproval and scowling at least, and you have to act like you don't see it.
He's infinite in his forgiveness, said I. It says so somewhere.
As should we all be, it also says, but I don't believe it. I've never forgiven our father for killing our mother, and I never shall. I don't believe, Pocket. There's no comfort or love there. I don't believe.
Me either, lady. So sod Jesus. Surely Edmund will fall in love with you when you become closer, and he's had a chance to murder your husband. Love needs room to grow, like a rose. Or a tumour.
He's passionate enough, although never so enthusiastic as that first night of the Tower.
Have you introduced him to your, well, special tastes?
Those will not win his heart.
Nonsense, love. A black-hearted prince like Edmund verily starves to have his bum smacked by a fair damsel like yourself. Probably what he's craving, just too shy to ask.
I think another has caught his eye. I think he fancies my sister.
No, that's his father's eye she caught. Well, speared, really, I thought. But then I thought better.
Perhaps I can help you resolve the conflict, Pumpkin. And at that, I produced the red and blue vials from my purse. I explained how one was for death-like sleep and the other afforded more permanent rest. And as I did so, I cradled the silk purse that still held the last puffball the witches had given me. What if I were to use it on Goneril? Bewitch her to love her own husband. Surely Albany would forgive her. He was a noble chap, despite being a noble. And with that, Regan could have that villain Edmund for herself, and the conflict between the sisters would be settled. Edmund would be satisfied with his new role as Duke of Cornwall and Earl of Gloucester, and all would be well. Of course, there were the issues of France attacking, Lear in the dungeon, and a wise and comely fool whose fate was uncertain.
Pumpkin, said I,
perhaps if you and Regan came to an understanding, perhaps if she were put to sleep until her army had done its duty against France, perhaps mercy. And that was as far as I got, as the bastard Edmund came through the door at that moment.
What is this? Demanded the bastard.
Don't you fucking knock, said I. Bloody common bastard. You'd have thought, now that I, too, was a half-noble bastard, that my disdain for Edmund might have diminished. Strangely, no.
Guard, take this worm to the dungeon until I have